Good afternoon. My name is Leslie Goldstein, attorney registration number 24658. I represent Mark Ashley. With all due respect to the state, it is Mr. Ashley's position that the trial court, the district attorney, and now the attorney general's office has completely missed the point about what this case is about. This is not about trial strategy and whether it was reasonable to pursue an attempted sex assault defense. This is a true Burglarude issue. And what I mean by that is, by conceding that Mr. Ashley was the assailant, but he did not actually complete the sex assault, his attorney effectively conceded guilt. And that deprived Mr. Ashley of his fundamental right to present a defense, to testify, and to enter a plea of not guilty. In Burglarude, the Colorado Supreme Court set forth a four-pronged test for analyzing these types of issues that arise in a conflict of interest case. Number one, they looked at the timeliness of the motion when the defendant raised that issue to the court. Two, they wanted to see what the adequacy of the trial court's inquiry into that conflict was. Three, whether the attorney-client conflict was so great that it resulted in a total lack of communication or deterioration in that attorney-client relationship, which prevented an adequate defense. And four, whether or not the defendant substantially contributed to that underlying conflict and whether or not it was unreasonable.
Ms. Goldstein, pardon me for interrupting, but let me ask you a threshold question.
Please.
I start with the premise that Burglarude wasn't even the law when your client was tried. But putting that aside, and all the procedural niceties that came out of that, the Burglarude case, including the four factors that you're talking about, Burglarude arose in a context of a direct appeal from a conviction where the defendant, one of the arguments was the trial court erred by denying my request for substitute counsel. This case comes up on a 35C where ineffective assistance was and is the primary argument, although clearly you're making an argument about constitutional rights as well. And so, why does Burglarude control his case at all?
Great question. I believe that it's clear that Burglarude is not new case law. In fact, what Burglarude is doing is clarifying well-existing case law. For instance, Cronic, Ferretta, Arguello, Jones v. Barnes. These cases are all from the 70s and 80s, which talked about what the trial court is tasked with when it's faced with a conflict of interest and or the defendant requests to have substitute counsel.
But when I read your briefs, at the end of the day, what you're arguing is ineffective assistance of counsel, which allows you to get in on a 35C. I don't see anywhere in your briefs, although you talk about Burglarude, you cite all this law, I don't see where you are directly attacking the trial court's order, various orders over years, denying your client's requests for substitute counsel.
I believe that the ineffective assistance of counsel claim is a derivative from the conflict of interest claim, because what happened is counsel looked at the case and made a decision to concede guilt and go for an attempted second degree or attempted sex assault. In other words, he conceded that Mr. Ashley was there. And based on that decision, it colored every aspect of how he handled the case, from whether or not to interview witnesses to obtain additional testing on DNA, to canvass the neighborhood, try and attempt to interview perhaps any witnesses that were there. And instead, he went with the theory, defendant was there, but this sex assault was not completed. And so it's our position that ineffective assistance of counsel stemmed from that conflict where the attorney took the choice away from Mr. Ashley about whether or not to pursue what defense. And he effectively pled Mr. Ashley guilty against Mr. Ashley's wishes. And I think it's very clear from early on, from 4 months prior to the trial, that there were documented problems between Mr. Ashley and his counsel. I think they were fairly hostile to each other in that November 2002 hearing. I think it's disappointing, not only is it disappointing that the trial court said, I hope things work out between the two of you and best of luck to you. The problem is not only Gergerud, which is a more recent case clearly, but Arguello, Ferretta, Chronic all talk about the fact that the trial court's got to make these substantive inquiries as to what the underlying conflict and dispute was between counsel and the defendant, and then based on receiving this information of the substantive dispute, could then make a ration decision about what to do and whether or not to appoint conflict-free counsel.
If you're correct, counsel, why isn't that an issue that could have been raised on direct appeal? And why isn't it therefore successive?
It was not raised on direct appeal. I believe the way this looked when post-conviction counsel came out, this is right after the Court of Appeals opinion in Burberry came out, and that's the way post-conviction counsel reviewed it. I think the concern here, though, is that we have fundamental constitutional rights that Mr. Ashley was deprived of, and indeed, for all intents and purposes, Mr. Ashley is serving a life sentence, which more than likely he will die in prison. He received a 54-year-to-life sentence, and he's middle-aged right now. And so the fact that his constitutional rights, he was deprived of those, should cause everyone concern about what is happening. So I would ask the court that I think these fundamental problems started at the trial court, and for reasons which I still really don't understand, everyone has talked about this in terms of trial strategy and whether or not it was reasonable under Strickland. And what Bergerud clearly says is that you can't take that decision away. And Bergerud is based off of Arguello and Ferretta, which talks about that the defendant has an absolute right to make these choices. And if that's the choice the defendant makes, then it's up to defense counsel to hold the state to that heavy burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, which certainly did not happen here.
But Bergerud is also based, I mean, all the holdings in Bergerud are based on the assumption that there was an effective assistance of counsel. And here, you have a trial court, post-conviction court, who makes findings, holds an evidentiary hearing, makes findings, including credibility findings, and says there was no ineffective assistance or there was no prejudice, and as a result, these constitutional rights weren't violated. So, I mean, I don't understand. I know your briefs say the trial court ignored these constitutional issues, but the trial court made specific rulings on those issues. They made, I realize you say they're wrong, and that's our job to figure that out, but I don't see where the trial court ignored it.
With all due respect, Judge, I think the trial court, the trial court judge looked at this from the context of ineffective assistance of counsel, looked at the DNA evidence that was presented at trial and other circumstances, and said she based on those things that was reasonable. But that does ignore the fact that Mr. Ashley has an absolute right to plead not guilty and say, I wasn't there, I had nothing to do with this. And in fact, this ties in from the get-go. During opening statements, he conceded, there was a pretty colorful language in the opening statements conceding that Mr. Ashley had ejaculated and that he, in fact, was there and had attempted to sexually assault the victim. The problem is, then when we come down the line and it's the Curtis advisement, Mr. Ashley says, why are you even asking me these questions? Why are you making such a big deal about this being my choice? This isn't even my choice. Everything else has been done by my lawyer.
Well, let me interrupt you there for a minute. Where in the transcript does he say that?
It's during the Curtis advisement.
Can you point me to a page where he says
yes.
that? Because it seems to me that it was pretty undisputed that he chose not to testify and told the judge this because he didn't want his priors to come out in front of the jury.
I think it's important for the court to look at that because during Curtis advisements, okay, it's on page 201 of volume 6, Your Honor.
Thank you.
And it actually, I believe, starts on page, or 201, line 1. It goes through, and yes, the court does document you have these four prior felony convictions. But on page 203, that's when Mr. Ashley says, why is this decision so important? I didn't have any other decisions. And I think that directly ties into what was going on in Bergerud, where there is a concession, and that effectively stripped Mr. Ashley of an opportunity to present an alibi defense. And so, even though, yes, I understand that Bergerud is a more recent case, it still talks about this was taking away a fundamental right from Mr. Ashley. And so, this gets back, I think, to the court's original question, where I do believe that the trial court missed the point. The trial court solely focused on whether or not this was appropriate trial strategy, but did not look at the context. And again, I'm concerned when I reread the trial court ruling from the bench, that the trial court didn't seem to think the opening statements in Mr. Ashley's case were as nearly egregious as the opening statements that were made in Bergerud. And as you know, in Bergerud, the Colorado Supreme Court said, you know what, that wasn't actually a concession. Defense counsel stopped short of conceding these things. That cannot be said about what happened in the opening statement here. It is clear defense counsel was saying Mr. Ashley was there and attempted to sexually assault the victim. So I think there's definitely fundamental differences between the facts of Bergerud and what happened here.
How is there prejudice, counsel, given the DNA evidence? How is there possibly prejudice?
With all due respect, I don't think we're talking, you're looking at this from an ineffective assistance of counsel standard, the Strickland v. Washington standard, about whether or not defendants suffered prejudice. We're looking at this from a conflict of interest standard and whether or not Mr.
If you look at it from a conflict of interest standard instead of an IAC claim, aren't you stuck with successiveness on the basis that it could have been raised in a direct appeal?
I don't believe so because
the conflict of interest can always be raised in a direct appeal, can it?
It can be, but it was not. And I think because of these...
Isn't that what the standard says? If it could have been, but it wasn't, then it's successive? Don't we have to look at this as a 35C in order to review the claim?
Well, yes, clearly it is a post-conviction issue. It was raised post-conviction. But what we have here is the information that post-conviction counsel went with, which I think became clear upon the ruling from the Court of Appeals at the time the Bergerud issue came out.
But you can't have it both ways. You're telling me there's all these cases back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s that established the law. So why isn't post-conviction counsel stuck with that law?
Again, I would say that Mr. Ashley is serving a life sentence, and the fact that his fundamental constitutional rights to plead not guilty and have the state prove his case beyond a reasonable doubt, he was stripped of that by counsel, and because of that, he did not have a fair trial. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You got about 30 seconds for rebuttal if you want it.
May it please the court, my name is Melissa Allen, registration number 23155, and I'm here on behalf of the people. I think that taking a step back that the court did take is paramount to making a decision on how to rule on this case, because the bottom line is that this is a 35C alleging ineffective assistance of counsel, and we have a very clear standard, which this court knows, of what needs to be proved to show ineffective assistance of counsel. And in this case, so we have to look at what the evidence that we have, the information we have in the record as far as whether counsel's performance was deficient and whether it prejudiced the defense.
Pardon me, counsel, why couldn't we look at the conflict issue that's been raised by the defense counsel here? Can we?
If you looked at it under the Strickland standard, I would say yes, you can, you could look at it. If the conflict is truly demonstrates ineffective assistance of counsel, then I think it can be raised in a 35C. But if it's just being raised as a conflict, I think that because it could have been and should have been raised on direct appeal, we shouldn't be addressing specifically the conflict in a 35C.
And outside the context of ineffective assistance of counsel.
Yes. Yes.
So let me try to expand on Judge Terry's question a little bit, because people are throwing around the words conflict of interest here. And there are conflict of interest cases, and then there are cases alleging total breakdown in communication, which is a kind of conflict. But a true conflict is, you know, the defense counsel represents the defendant and a key witness or somebody like that. We don't have any of that here. What we have is, I think, my lawyer wasn't talking to me, he wasn't listening to me, we're not communicating, and am I right that under a 35C ineffective assistance of counsel rubric, we can look at that kind of issue?
Yes, for the lack of communication, if for instance, the lack of communication led to no investigation, right, on the part of defense counsel, or something like that, then you get into those issues of not doing your job, of falling under the one half of the test of whether counsel's performance was deficient. And but again, you have to prove prejudice. And I think that it's clear in this case, I mean, not only did we have DNA that irrefutably proved that the defendant was there and did do this, but she, separate from that, the victim independently identified him as the perpetrator in a photo lineup. So you've got these two very huge pieces of evidence that pretty much lock this case. And he did, it would be my position, what was the only effective thing to do, which was try to get the jury to buy that the sexual assault was never completed, that it was an attempt. And don't get me wrong, I don't disagree that there is evidence in the record that they were not communicating very well necessarily. But I disagree that the defendant did not know what was going on. I think if you look, I think he actually possibly calculatedly waited until he couldn't be cross-examined to profess his innocence in front of the jury during rebuttal closing argument, when you know, that was the last word merely.
So you, indeed, at the pretrial conference, right, the day before trial, he says, I'm not claiming that they misprepared this case in any way. They just don't like me.
They just don't like me. That's exactly what he said. I have the wrong brief in front of me, but he made a comment. The court said, so you don't like what they're doing for you? And he said, no, that's not what I'm saying. And then the next morning he said, I'm not happy with the way they're wanting to defend. The morning of trial, he makes that comment. Meanwhile, he sat through the hearings where they explained why they weren't going to fight the DNA evidence, because they didn't want the jury knowing that he's already in the criminal system in CODIS. All of this stuff happened in front of him. And it's unclear which one it is. Was he completely shocked by the closing argument wherein his defense attorney continues to, you know, place him at the scene? Or was he shocked all along because opening statement did the same thing and he kind of, and so did voir dire, kind of knew the direction it was going? I mean, you can't have it both ways. And again, I think that that's getting almost too deep into the issue, the Bergeron issue, because for purposes of this appeal, we have to look at it under the ineffective assistance rubric. And I just think that under that, both prongs fail, and the trial court properly denied the motion.
Let me talk about the prejudice prong, and with respect to the kidnapping charge. If we were to look just at the prejudice prong for that, how could we conclude that there was no prejudice as a result of the counsel stating and his opening statement that there was kidnapping?
Did he, I don't mean to ask the question.
At some point, either in opening or closing, defense counsel said something, you know, find him guilty, maybe even of kidnapping, something along that line.
Well, I think that in that regard, I mean, how do you separate out the two charges? They're part and parcel of each other. If his
help me understand that. Why do you say that?
Well, if his DNA is there, then he is there. And if what he's saying is, I wanted to say I wasn't there at all, it's not, if he's not there at all, then this other person committed, both crimes. So he either they were committed the way that she said that they were committed, or he tries to lessen the sex assault. Or if he's not there, how can he argue against, how do you argue against the kidnapping when she's saying the person moved her at knife point behind the alley? I mean, I think that the only thing that they had going for them, which defense counsel picked up on here, was that the biological evidence was completely outside the victim, and that's what he went with, attempt. That was the only way to lower any of the, I'm not sure I'm actually answering your question correctly.
I can't help but counsel.
I'm sorry, I mean, is there anything more?
You can proceed to the next point you wanted to make.
Let's see. I guess I didn't know how much more, you know, you wanted me to get into the kind of the history of the case and how it all went down, but it just seems to me that, you know, at some points he's saying he disagrees with the defense, at other points he's saying he's surprised by it, and you can't have it both ways. And again, the time to have raised this to deal with whether counsel should have been removed and another attorney should have been appointed on the case and all of what goes into that, that should have been raised on direct appeal. And now that we're here in a 35C, I think even as this issue is raised, this court is constrained by the Strickland prongs. And again, I don't believe that prejudice can be proved or that counsel's performance was deficient. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Goldstein, if you want it, you got about 30 seconds.
I'm going to take it. I would just respond to Judge Terry. The trial court chose to resolve this on substantive grounds and did not resolve it on procedural grounds, and I would ask the court to do so as well. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel for your very helpful arguments. The case will stand submitted. A division will issue an opinion in due course.